This is Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming nationwide on the 710 Sports app and 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Time to put on the show.
It is Danny Gallant. It's Tuesday, which means we've not only got Brock Heward under center, we've got Brock Heward in studio for Blue 42.
Here we go.
This is Coors Light's Blue 42.
We're going to go red, right, tight, close, sprint left, G, U corner, halfback, flat, on two. Ready, right.
Blue 42 is brought to you by Coors Light. The mountains turn blue at 42 degrees.
Blue 42!
Now here's your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Blue 42! Blue 42!
Morning, Brock. How are you?
Good morning, Danny. I got breaking news for you. I just
What's
shared
your breaking
with,
news?
With Jessamine before I walked in here. I'm going to wear her most difficult hat. I'm going to be a sideline analyst this weekend in the XFL.
Oh, let's go.
Yeah.
Brock and I both in Houston this weekend for various reasons.
That's exactly right. So, yeah, I don't know who or how many guys said no until they finally called someone to say yes on Saturday. So I will get to do the inaugural Houston-LA Wildcats game in Houston Saturday on Fox.
I've got one question, and this isn't question one. Are you going to talk to Clayton about using a fanny pack?
Possibly. Yeah, possibly. An XFL fanny pack.
That'd be great.
Really, really strong. Probably get it with some glitter and, yeah, all just...
Yeah, bedazzled.
Yeah, I can do that for you.
Oh.
I've got a hot glue gun.
Do you really? Oh, yeah. Just bedazzle that sucker. Bling, bling, bling. All right, here we go. Question one.
What does Patrick Mahomes bring to the table that Russell does not, Brock?
Yeah, I was listening to you guys driving in, and I think both of you guys were spot on. It's just the size. It's being 6'3", 230. But I will say this. Blessings can also be curses. And he took a beating in that Super Bowl.
He did.
For 2 years, he's been a starter. This year, he actually missed games with that dislocated kneecap, came back, fought through it the year before. I believe he had an ankle injury, a toe injury, a lower body injury that he had also kind of battled through, and he did, and he didn't miss any games. But sometimes you think you're big and you're powerful and you're invincible until you're not, and you start to take a beating. And that would be my biggest concern as you kind of look at Russell and Mahomes. And if, like, this day you say, yep, Mahomes is a step ahead of him. Well, Russell's got an 8-year track record of being unbelievably meticulous in taking care of himself. I mean, it is, when you are around him on a day-to-day basis in season, it is scary, the maniacal nature that he goes about taking care of himself so he can be available every single day. And I think that will be the challenge for a very young, gifted Patrick Mahomes. That's where they're different. Mahomes got the advantage with some size and strength. I think Russell's got the advantage of an unbelievable discipline on a daily basis to do everything imaginable to be available. We'll see if Mahomes could do the same.
Is it possible that Russ's size lends itself to maybe being a little bit more able to withstand the hits?
Yes. Oh, I don't think there's any question, man. He is so strong. Now, Mahomes also strong. I mean, Mahomes, you saw it. He took some violent hits. He had Jimmy Ward out of the game by bouncing off of him. I'll be curious in 5 years or in 10 years if there's not a little more Ben Roethlisberger comp to Patrick Mahomes. Mm. Right? If he gets to 240, if he gets to 245, if he's just a big old dude back there that realizes, yeah, I'm not going to just be scrambling around and stiff-arming dudes and having guys run into me, but I'm going to be a big man in that pocket that those guys just cannot bring down. I mean, he had a play earlier where he scrambled and there were two 49ers that hit him. Out of 32 starting quarterbacks, 30 of them go down, but he's able to kind of fight through. It almost propelled him into like a 10-yard scramble. That's a big, strong man.
It's an interesting decision for Mahomes going forward because I think he's incredibly cat-like for a quarterback. Now, he's not Kyler Murray, and he's not quite Russell Wilson either, right. But I do think that there is a nimbleness to the way that he runs around, and if he were to bulk up, maybe that wouldn't be the case.
There is, but there's also, when Russell was 24, his quickness and speed were a notch above what Mahomes is.
Right.
Right? Mahomes just does it at 6'3", 230. I think that's where he's more unique. But we know in time you are going to add some weight. In time you are going to get beat up in this league. And in time, he's going to have that razor-sharp discipline that Russell has shown for 8 years that I do think sets him apart.
Question two. Seahawks dealing with a lot of injuries this offseason. Which one to you is the most intriguing and challenging?
Chris Carson. Justin Britt's ACL, you know how that goes. Michael Kendrick's ACL, you know how that goes. Those guys have already, I think, had surgery and on the road to recovery. We saw this with Lano Hill last year, and we saw it really limit him the entire offseason. He was a non-participant in OTAs and minicamps, and he was literally and figuratively a step behind this season with that hip injury. Seahawks seem to think it doesn't need surgery. But anytime you have an injury like that, you don't want to go in. They don't need to go in and have surgery. I think that's a positive. But at the same time, there's a massive amount of unknown. And that's a guy that likes to train. That's a guy that loves to take care of himself, who has really accentuated his body and his physique in his time here in Seattle. And, you know, what and how does that progress? He's a big part of what they were. You saw that without him. I mean, he was a gigantic part of just defining their personality, of accentuating their scheme. And, you know, he's a guy that wants his. He's going to want to get paid here soon, as all young running backs do. And so just kind of monitoring that, watching that with so much unknown, without a surgery, you know, with a rehab that is going to be kind of difficult to define, with a player itching to get back out there, with a significant enough hip injury that A, it knocks him out of the season, and B, probably 3 or 4 months of very little activity. That's one I'll be watching closely.
Brock, you mentioned his desire to get paid.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any doubt. He's eligible for an extension. He's a 7th-round pick. He's going to want an extension. He is a big part of what Seattle does. Do you extend him?
I don't think you can extend him this offseason, Dan, just because of those unknowns. I think you want to see him go about it and get it done again and just say, hey, I know you would like some. Now, is there an opportunity to get a favorable deal? A Marco Gonzalez, yep. Right? Evan White. So from a player perspective, he wants to get paid. I don't think the team has any desire to pay him $7, $8, $9 million, wherever he thinks or his agent thinks he would rank as a top 5 rusher in this league. But all of a sudden, is there a chance to get some millions of dollars and say, okay, we'll get you a 3-year extension, but it's going to be on our number. And that number may be $5 or $6 million in generational wealth for you, but certainly not market value to what your agent is spewing your way. So that would be the only scenario. But even there, Danny, he's been injured all 3 years, basically, of his career. He's been a guy that's been unable to be consistent over the entirety of his football career, high school, junior college, college, and even these 3 years. So I'd be a bit apprehensive to signing that check.
Brock, it's interesting you talk about the injury history and sort of extending guys. It's what Seattle's been best at.
Yep.
Is guys coming off of their rookie deals, extending those contracts, because that's a point where you do have a little bit of leverage. You can get a little bit of value. But the thing is, you have to be right. You're making a decision on that guy's future a year before you have to. I think one of the most remarkable things that John Schneider's done is that he has not missed in those cases. Mm-hmm. When he's extended a guy out in front, when he's got 1 year left on his rookie deal, he has nailed it every single
time.
Would
you say, though, Danny, you did not do that with Frank Clark?
Right. They chose not to.
Chose not to with Ifedi. Chose not to with Frank Clark.
Yep.
Frank got his $20 million. I bet you Ifedi's going to get paid somewhere.
Yes, he is.
Here in Seattle.
He's not going to be here.
No, and he's going to get paid elsewhere. So, yeah, when they made that choice, they have been right and nearly spot on. They've also, over the last couple years, not made that choice on a couple guys. And those guys have gotten paid handsomely elsewhere.
Question 3. Brock, at age 28, how much better can James Garoppolo get? We've decided we're going to call him James instead of James.
James Richard, right, Lydia?
James Richard Garoppolo. James Richard?
Well, I heard you guys talking about that on the drive-in, that he did not have a defining moment. I think they would argue the New Orleans Saints toe-to-toe with Drew Brees in a game that
Come
meant
on.
An awful lot.
Right. He threw like a 5-yard pass to George Kittle, and Kittle ran down the field with a guy hanging off his face mask. Jimmy didn't do anything.
Yeah, didn't he throw for like 400 yards that day,
though? He threw for a lot of yards. He did have a 75-yard touchdown pass. It was not the best 75-yard touchdown pass. It involved a little bit of tangling and trippage. But
yes.
That was right when they were down 20-7, an immediate answer to a Saints touchdown.
But if you're pro Jimmy, you're going to look at that and say that was a game off of a difficult Baltimore loss where they went toe-to-toe with the Ravens on the road. They had to win. Right? It was that gauntlet of Seattle and Baltimore and in New Orleans, one of the most difficult places to play in New Orleans. You had to go get a win, and Drew Brees went crazy, and your defense got gashed in ways it did not get gashed all season long. And he had to respond and did. And yes, George Kittle made the defining play at the end, breaking the tackle. But you know, he was still the guy to get that done. If you're a 49er fan or you're 49er brass and you believe in Jimmy Garoppolo, that's a game you point to and say that was a meaningful game. That was end of season. You don't win that game, you're not the number one seed. The playoffs going through San Francisco and ultimately getting to that Super Bowl. If you're on the other side of it, which I think you two are, which I would probably be a little bit closer to, you look at that fourth quarter and say, man, there was not one chance. There was not two chances. There were three really big plays where you just want to stare them in the eye and say, hey, man, this is a Super Bowl. And you can't go 3 for 7, 30 yards in the fourth quarter and miss third down after third down after third down. That little shot of Kyle Shanahan and John Lynch was right on his back shoulder on that third down post route to Mosley. They've been sitting on that. To Emmanuel Sanders. They've been sitting on that play, right? You're waiting for that moment. Okay, we're between the 40s. We're going to expect to get this bracket coverage. You get everything you wanted. That's why Shanahan was like backpedaling as that play was going. Former receiver sees the game through a quarterback's eyes. He knows what he's going to get. And just put air on that ball. You just yacked that one, man. You did grip that tight, and you just did not let it go and give your guy a chance to go finish the deal for you. So that fourth quarter, very, very concerning, Danny. And I don't know if it's quite sour milk. I don't know if you use that comparison or analogy with quarterbacks like you do kickers. Once it goes sour in a big moment like that, you are going to be apprehensive until he proves in that big moment he can indeed get it done.
What's he best at? Because it does feel like the 49ers around him more than they work through him.
I would say he, if you were to go watch him throw, Paul, if you were to join your 7-on-7 team, and I know with your wrist injury, you're probably not catching any of his passes right now.
Yeah, it's going to be tough tonight playing with this.
Yes, but if you were to come out, you go, wow, this guy can really throw the ball, like consistently, really throw the ball. And so when he's clean and the pocket is clean, he's mechanically clean. He's got, I wouldn't say a plus arm, but he's right there at league average, if not a little bit more. And he's pretty good fundamentally. I think those are all areas of some strength. Whenever, though, things break down, and when there's ever pressure on him, either the pressure of the moment or certainly people in his face, throwing the ball to the perimeter is the biggest step. To long-winded answer, Danny, to answer, can he get better at 28? He's got to get better in those pressure moments, and he's got to get better pushing the ball outside those numbers. Those would be the two huge areas of improvement that he's got to take.
Brock, how do you know when one player is absolutely going after another player's neck?
Ooh.
The answer is when they mention their salary. Frank Clark to Fox Sports' Peter Schrager, quote, you paying the guy $140 million, $130 million, whatever he's getting paid, man, he's got to throw the ball. Obviously, he didn't do that. They threw for about 200 yards on checkdowns. That ain't enough to win a game against us, end quote.
I thought Chris Myers had one of the sneaky good lines in the Super Bowl when he was interviewing Frank and the Honey Badger.
Yes.
And Frank is going on and on and on. And Chris Myers is like, well, we got to get this guy his own show, you know? And then he turns to Honey Badger. Frank's not afraid of that microphone.
No, his world tour is just beginning.
We're only getting started, sure, yes. Yeah.
Apparently, he wants his Super Bowl ring sized for his middle finger.
Yeah.
Wow.
he's beauty.
All the haters out there is like, yeah, all the haters that traded a first and a second round pick and paid you $20 million. Like, I'm not sure if you're
I still remember
sure disrespected.
Sitting in the studio like a year ago, and G. Scott was in for one of his Wednesday mornings, and we were talking about Frank. He's like, you know who Frank is? You can't pay Frank. Frank's your crazy uncle that comes to the party. Like, you don't give your crazy uncle just all that dough. Because crazy uncle's already crazy, and then he could just go off the rocker, which we may see with Mr. Clark this offseason.
Brock, it's always fun to talk to you. We appreciate you stopping by. We look forward to talking to you on Tuesday.
Yeah, we'll do it.
On Thursday.
We'll do it on Thursday, and thanks to Tony Pion for making it all happen. See you, boys.
See you soon. This is Brock Heward. That is Blue 42. The disappointment hanging over the air in San Francisco. Paul went and put an ear out, listened, and eavesdropped. Spent a chunk of last night eavesdropping on what they were saying in San Francisco.
It was really joyous. I'm not going to lie. I got a little bit too into it because I thought to myself at first, Danny, I'm going to listen to 1 hour. That 1 hour became a second hour. The second hour became a third hour. I almost went to a fourth, and I was like, okay, I think I have a problem right now. I'm reveling way too much in the misery of the San Francisco 49ers. But yeah, decided to compile some of the phone calls who were very upset with what had happened to their beloved San Francisco 49ers, not the Cincinnati Bengals, in Super Bowl 54. Put a little bit of music to it as well.
Oh, man, this is devastating, guys.
Man, that was terrible, man. I mean, Latrell's Freewell, man. Bunch of choke artists, man.
Towards the end of the game, that defensive pass interference in the end zone, that's a punt call.
This is driving me nuts, man. I mean, we're the San Francisco 49ers, and I feel sorry for Joe Staley, dude.
Yeah.
I mean, dude, can you imagine him two times in the Super Bowl that took him about three coaches to get back there? He was 0-2 in a... Dude, we're not the Cincinnati Bengals, man. We're the 49ers.
Can somebody tell me why did the genius Kyle Shanahan had decided to throw on second and down? The Niners were averaging 6 yards, and they only ran the ball 22 times last night. Deb, I wish Mike Shanahan was coaching and not Kyle. In the words of John Calipari, a successful person never loses. He either wins or learns. I guess Andy Reid learned, and I guess Kyle haven't.
The Niners are going to have a real long offseason. I don't know what the Richard Sherman going to be thinking about this offseason, because Darrell Revis with his mojo,
hey,
I believe we'll get one in the next 5 years, I'd say. But within 5 years, we'll have a Super Bowl. Promise you that one.
So
I think
good.
I'm not sure if my favorite is that we're not the Cincinnati Bengals, or if my favorite is when the host gets mad at the guy cursing. Hey!
It's so good.
Yeah, I don't feel bad at all for laughing at their misery.
You know, I like the most the, I promise you, we'll win a Super Bowl in the next 5 years. Like, wow, real confident in your team's ability to get back to the Super Bowl the next year, bro.
I was really interested to hear what the main objection was among, and on one of the shows on 95.7 The Game, Bonte, Steiny, and Guru. Their main objection, I think the one thing everybody agreed on is that Kyle Shanahan butchered the clock at the end of the first half by not using timeouts. And it's really an interesting question, because the scenario is essentially the Chiefs are going to punt the ball with about 2 minutes left. San Francisco has all three timeouts. And the cameras actually showed, so there's like minute 45 or so that's left. The camera actually showed John Lynch signaling for a timeout, expecting the 49ers to stop it. I certainly expected them to stop it. And he let it run. Shanahan let it run, and they got the ball back with a minute to go at their own 20-yard line. And he said afterward that he was concerned about giving the Chiefs another possession. He's still got three timeouts, so he's certainly given himself room to get a field goal if he wanted to. But then they ran it on the first play and, again, didn't burn a timeout. It was a very conservative approach. And here's what I would say. They certainly managed it in a way that compromised their own ability to score points. I don't see how you can reconcile being that scared to be aggressive against a Chiefs defense with less than 2 minutes to go in a game that's tied at the end of the first half, and why you decide in the fourth quarter that you're going to throw it because you need to move the sticks. I don't think you can reconcile those two things. Either you're afraid of your quarterback and you don't want to make mistakes, in which case you should have been running the ball in the fourth quarter, or you believe that your quarterback needs to execute the offense because you need to get first downs, in which case you have to use timeouts to give yourself the best chance of scoring at the end of the first half. One of those two, it was inconsistent, and I think it pointed out that kind of the spot that San Francisco's in is that they're in on Jimmy Garoppolo, but not all the way.
That's something that I found striking, too, because as I've thought about it more and more, Danny, they showed no faith in anything at the end of the first half. They were nihilists, essentially. It's not,
did you not believe in nothing?
Yes. It's not that they just were nervous that maybe Jimmy Garoppolo didn't have the ability to get them down the field with all that time left and score a touchdown. It's also that they did not have faith in their defense to take over and do what it did for most of the first half, and honestly for about 55 minutes of the game, to actually continue to do what it was doing against Kansas City's offense. They did a pretty good job in that game. And Kyle Shanahan took it out of both of those sides of the ball's hands. He was like, all right, well, I think the best approach here is to minimize Kansas City's ability, if we don't end up moving the football down the field, to get the ball back and to score. We're fine with it being 10-10 at halftime. We're fine getting the ball in the second half. And then down the stretch, for me, it's that they ran the football as little as they did. But I'm curious, too, Danny, about the idea that when I listen to a lot of the reservations and anger and frustrations that 49er fans and 49er analysts had about the Super Bowl, there did not seem to be as much, like, why doesn't Kyle Shanahan have the faith in Jimmy Garoppolo? It seemed like there was a lot of acceptance on that front. And honestly, I think that acceptance speaks volumes. That acceptance tells you that this is a fan base, this is a team that really knows that the guy's limited. They might think that there's another year that can happen and this guy could theoretically get better. They're kidding themselves. He's 28 years old. He is what he is at this point, which I think is a plus quarterback in this league, but it's not a guy that you're going to be able to rely on a regular basis. It's a guy that's going to be along for the ride, not taking you on the ride.
What should you do if you're a coach in that situation? Should you call the plays that you think need to be called there and say it's up to the guy to execute them? Or should you try to, like, stick a toe in the water and, like, take little baby steps and, like, maybe we can get through? Because in some respects, that's kind of what they did with Jimmy Garoppolo in the playoffs, right? They didn't ask him to do all that much. He threw 8 passes against Green Bay. And there's no reason to have him throw more passes if you're going to be able to run the ball like San Francisco was able to run it. But I think that you saw sort of that we're half in on the quarterback.
Right.
We're half in on the quarterback. And I think that that is something that really tipped the balance, that's something that tipped the scales.
And I don't know how you just put a toe in the water in a moment like this. You just have to take the plunge. And when you take the plunge, it might end up being just disaster. You might be like, oh, wow, this is freezing cold and miserable, and I don't want to do this at all. I want to get out. They were unwilling to do either. And that's a problem. You have to make strong decisions in this game. You can't do anything with half measures. To quote Mike Ehrmantraut in Breaking Bad, you go all in or you don't. And they chose to do a variety of different things that I think just show that they don't really have any strong convictions in any part of their team, which is fascinating considering they were probably the best running team in the NFL this past season, and they were one of the best defenses in the NFL this past season.
Are you the kind of person that dips a toe in and gradually moves into the cold pool, or do you dive in? It's a question for everybody, because I think that this is something that says something about yourself.
I've found that it's smartest. If you put your toe in the water, you're going to keep doing it. If you just jump in, you're going to get over it really quickly. And I think that I've actually made the decision, Danny, going forward. When I was in Miami a couple of weekends ago, getting in the water there, I was like, you know what? I could gradually wade in or I could just jump in and I'm going to feel great as soon as I jump in. And I jumped in, I felt great. And I feel like going forward, I am a just jump in guy, unless it's like Antarctica, because that's too cold.
What about the Pacific Ocean? Have you ever swam in the Pacific?
I have not, and I've heard it's frigid. I heard it's like 40, right?
Yeah, no, it's not 40 degrees. It's like 55, 60 degrees Northern California. We'll take you down there. Aptos, Manresa.
Do I need a body suit?
Catch some tasty waves. No, there's not if you're a guy that just jumps in all the way, which is the only way to do it.
This is true. Like I am enough of a weenie where I'm very nervous about the idea of the 55. But I suppose, you know what? If I'm a jump-in guy, I just got to jump in. Just got to do it.
The offseason is officially underway. The Seahawks are hosting a tight end. This is great news for them. We'll tell you who it is. Hint, he might be a broadcaster in the not-too-distant future. That's next.
You're listening to Danny and Gallant.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Greg Olson, tight end from the Carolina Panthers, is going to be visiting the Seattle Seahawks. This is great news, in my opinion. I think he would be a fantastic addition. And this is one of the only areas that being a successful franchise actually is an advantage in the NFL. Olson is not going to be returning to the Carolina Panthers. The idea that he is available right now because he was released by Carolina because he didn't want to be part of a rebuilding project means that you can essentially get a jump start on free agency because he's not an unrestricted free agent. He was let go by the Panthers. I'd love to see Seattle add him, Paul.
Did you see the video of him at the Super Bowl with Cam Newton? They were outside of a club. I think they'd had a couple to drink, and Cam Newton was just waxing poetically about how much he loved Greg Olson and all that Olson brought to the table. If Cam Newton's still the quarterback in Carolina next season, he's really going to miss Greg Olsen. And I think one of the things to think about with Greg Olsen this past year, ask yourself this question: is he a guy who is now starting to show signs of age at age 34? Or did he have a season where he ended up having, I think, 500-plus yards receiving, I think 52 receptions or so? Is that a result of just being in an offense that featured Kyle Allen? 52 receptions, 597 yards, 11.5 yards per reception, and 2 touchdowns. I mean, that's a pretty good season for a 14-game year, especially considering the guy's 34 years old.
Yeah, sign me up. And I guess I should preface that. If this is going to be a 2 or 3 year deal where he wants $5-6 million a season, no, I'm not into that. This is a 1 year deal at a relatively affordable salary. If he's not looking to lock down a multi-year commitment, I think that this is a no-brainer if he's interested in coming here. This is one of the only values that a winning team gets in the NFL, is that when you get a veteran who wants to play for a winner, that you can pitch yourself as, we've got a great quarterback, we've got a coach that understands players, it's a fantastic place to play, and we can guarantee you that you're going to contend. This is about the only, when you get a veteran like Olsen who's as interested in winning as he is in the salary he's going to command, that, look, what he said to Carolina was, I'm not interested in coming back to play at a rebuilding project. I would rather, because he's got options. At this point,
definitely.
At this point, and if anybody's heard him do games, a couple years ago when he was injured, he was part of the broadcast crew. Anybody that's heard him do games, he's fantastic. And he's probably getting very close to the point where his broadcasting income would rival his player salary. Like, that's going to be crossed here in the next couple of years. But the idea that you can, I think that this is a no-brainer. You add him, Will Disley's coming back, and you hope Disley is recovered and strong. And I'm not of the I'll believe it when I see it persuasion. I think he came back pretty strong from the injury he suffered, the patellar tendon injury. Now it's an Achilles, and not to say that I just assume he'll be fine, but I do believe he'll be back. I think he's built for playing in the NFL and playing through injuries. But you could absolutely use someone like Olsen. And right now, the team could use someone who kind of skews toward that, the receiving end of being a tight end.
Right. And, well, listen, here's the other thing, too. I mean, look at Jacob Hollister compared to Greg Olsen. And Jacob Hollister was a guy that was a practice squad player for the New England Patriots this past season. I mean, Greg Olsen's just a bigger guy than him. Greg Olsen's got an inch on him. He's got 10 pounds on him. This is like another big body, and you just did not have enough at the tight end position this past season. I mean, there were games where it was just Jacob Hollister essentially at tight end, right? And you were sort of putting George Fant in there, and you weren't 100% sure what position George Fant actually was. By the way, he's a free agent right now. So you need to have more than just one tight end. And, I you know, one of the things that I wonder about thinking back is if they were perhaps a little bit too optimistic about the idea of Ed Dixon returning, because that is someone that we did not see at all this past year.
Yeah, that's correct. And I think they became optimistic. I don't think they counted on it. They were really hoping for it once Disley got hurt. And when the season started, I don't think they had an expectation that Ed Dixon was going to play. And then when the injury started to impact that position, they looked at it and thought, okay, maybe we do really need him. It was weird the way the year unfolded. I'm not sure they still make the Nick Vinette trade if they knew Disley was going to get hurt. I think they probably wouldn't have. They got a fifth round pick for him, but that's Nick Vinette wasn't going to do anything other than sort of fill up space.
Right, and I don't necessarily have an issue with the Nick Vinette trade, and you followed Nick Vinette a lot more than I did. I just think it's interesting that they basically had one tight end when Will Disley got hurt, right? I mean, they didn't have another guy.
You know, you had Swoops that they brought up. I mean, having three tight ends and one guy on the injured reserve when the season started, that's not undermanned. It just quickly became undermanned because you had the trade followed by the injury. Then you've got George Fant mixed in there. It was a weird pile at the position. But that and running back were the two spots that they just kind of got decimated by injuries. And Hollister's a fine. Hollister should be on the team next year. But I would say if you have a group of Hollister, Olsen, and Disley, I would think you feel really good about that position.
Definitely. Now, I do wonder, though, is, you know, much like with Ed Dixon, I think you got to learn from the mistakes. You can't assume that Disley's going to be back. This is now back-to-back catastrophic injuries that he has suffered, and we're looking at a guy that, yeah, he made an incredible recovery from year, you know, what was it, tearing his ACL to last year, getting back on the field. Well, now we're talking about a totally different animal.
It is. Achilles injuries tend to have the biggest impact, or when you talk about it being a career-changing injury.
That's a big guy. That's a lot of weight to be putting on your heel.
Yeah. I as a side note, I would like you to explain that to Dave Wyman. He doesn't believe that bigger guys impacts their joints. He says it's all proportional. So having a bigger guy, he's just got, I'm with your school of thought that he is a big dude. The fact that Disley, I do believe Disley, you can expect him to be there. I don't know if you know how much you're going to be able to get out from him the whole season. Do you bank on him being one of the strong points of your offense? No, but do you bank on him being on the roster? Yes.
I bank on him being on the roster. I would operate with the mindset that he's not going to play. And I think that
that's
just...
Do you need a starter then?
I think you look at it in the draft. I think you look at drafting a tight end, definitely, because you don't know. You want to believe that Disley's going to be back, and it's so unfortunate that he suffered this injury because he's been such a steal. Like, if this is a healthy guy, what? That's a fifth-round pick that you brought in and you didn't really expect much out of, and not only is he good at blocking, but he's also a good receiver. Like, there's so much to love about the Wilt Disley pick, but that's the thing. I think sometimes you got to assume the worst, and when you operate assuming the worst, then you end up finding things along the way that you wouldn't be preparing for if you just assumed that everything you've got is gravy.
I believe that Greg Olsen would be a great compliment to Disley, and if Disley isn't able to come back, you know that he can handle the workload of an NFL season, and you still got Jacob Hollister. If those are the three tight ends that you have entering the season, I feel really good about that position, certainly much better over the course of the year. And this is an opportunity to make a pitch on and get out in front of free agency, essentially. You're getting a chance to shop for a guy before the market opens. This is a great opportunity. I really hope to see. And look, this will be telling depending on how many teams that Greg Olsen goes and visits. We've seen this sort of tour before where guys will use Seattle to leverage salary negotiations. Jared Allen did it most memorably.
Yep.
I don't want the Seahawks in a bidding war. I don't think that works for players at this end of their. If Greg Olsen is looking to wring every last dollar he can, which is totally his prerogative, I don't want to get in a bidding war over a 34-year-old tight end. But if he wants to come and play here, I am absolutely excited about that. Like, how can we set this up?
And you're not going to get in a bidding war. I just don't think that's going to happen because I think Olsen knows that he's got probably a pretty lucrative TV deal, as you mentioned a little bit earlier, in the works, say he doesn't get a job with the team. Honestly, I think the fact that he's still looking to play, which I thought after hearing that the Panthers and he were mutually agreeing to part ways, I figured we'd hear a Greg Olsen retirement or something like that very soon, but that he's still willing to play, I think he just wants to win. He wants to actually get back to a Super Bowl, and he wants to take it home this time. And if that's what he's looking for, there are very few opportunities where not only is Greg Olsen going to have a chance to play, but also have a legitimate shot at a Super Bowl. This is one of the very few.
Would you worry at all about, you mentioned he got caught 50 passes last season. I don't know if he's going to catch 50 passes in Seattle.
Oh, I doubt he would. I would guess like 30, 25 to 30 or something.
Would
like
you
that.
Worry about that? Do you have to advertise that to him up front? Because
I'm just going to keep going back to this. If you're 34 years old and you still want to play, I don't think you care about stats. You want the ring. That's all you want.
I tend to agree with you, but you've got to make sure that he's of that mindset. Because there are guys that when they're 34, look at it and say like, hey, I'm still really good. I'm still at the money making. I'm still in the sweet spot of my career.
And I'm sure he still thinks he's good. I think you have to have some confidence to continue wanting to play. But also he's not like a diva tight end, you know? It's not like he's what Travis Kelce, I imagine, will end up being at the end of his career. You know, we're talking about a guy in Greg Olsen, who I think seems to be just universally liked across the NFL. I don't think he's that kind of a guy.
When the professor disagrees with you, you realize you have to go back to the drawing board. So Paul did. How much talent does Seattle have on the defensive side of things? He'll tell us next.
You are listening to Danny and Gallant.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Yesterday, we were talking about the Seahawks defense. I think, Danny, we both agree that it's a unit that's going to need some reinforcements this offseason, specifically at the pass rush. I think when we talked about the Kansas City Chiefs, they were able to overhaul things pretty quickly this past offseason and turn their defense, at the very least, into a unit that we both described as average. I don't think the Seahawks are that close to being at that average level because of some of the changes and turnover that might be happening this offseason in the pass rush with Jadeveon Clowney and Jaren Reed, and also because I just don't think they don't have that many playmakers in the secondary after a Quandre Diggs. Well, John Clayton yesterday on his show played some of our audio back from that segment, and he disagreed with me.
Shaquille Griffin went to the Pro Bowl, okay? And sure, he may not get the interceptions, but just like I was talking about with the San Francisco 49ers in 2018, unless you can get pressure on the quarterback, you can't get the interceptions. You can't get those big plays. You know, the Seattle Seahawks have two Pro Bowl caliber safeties. Bradley McDougal went to the was a Pro Bowl alternate in 2018, and Quandre Diggs, who's really good at free safety, was a Pro Bowl alternate for the last 2 years. So that means you have three Pro Bowl quality guys in the secondary. Trey Flowers is the one that now has to start to play catch up. And then, you know, you look on linebacking core. I mean, Bobby Wagner's probably the best middle linebacker in football. You've got K.J. Wright, who's been to the Pro Bowl. Jadeveon Clowney, whose contract is up, and they've got to find a way to re-sign him. And, you know, I know that it was not a good season for Jaren Reed, but again, Jaren Reed had 10.5 sacks back in 2018 and still a very good run stopper.
He listed seven guys there. Do you feel, Danny, that this defense is as talented as John made it out to be?
No. I think that they've got some name recognition. There was certainly something lacking in the way that they executed. How many stars do they have? They've got, in my mind, they've got one star. Bobby Wagner. Bobby Wagner's a star player. Bobby Wagner's a really, really reliable middle linebacker. Bobby Wagner's a star. The rest are, you have a collection of good players, a couple of whom may become great, but nobody that's sort of taken that next step forward and popped. Shaquille Griffin is as close as it is, but look, part of playing cornerback and being an elite cornerback is taking the ball away.
Yes, it is, and that's not something he doesn't do yet. He separates the ball from receivers. But interceptions have not happened yet. Is that the next step? Perhaps it is. Going back to Bobby Wagner, Danny, is Bobby Wagner a star when he was not as effective in coverage as we have seen him in years past, and he was asked to be in coverage as much as he was?
I don't know if I buy the measurements that I've seen saying he was a liability.
Which was Pro Football Focus.
I don't know if I buy, and this would be, because stating that as a given, that, hey, he wasn't as good in coverage, well, how do we know it was his coverage responsibilities? And how do we know that it wasn't the fact that they were in more base linebacker, in more base defense, as opposed to having a nickel out there? Bobby's always been pretty good in coverage, and certainly his speed. And maybe he did suffer in that regard. If that's the case, change your defensive template in those situations. Bobby Wagner, by the biggest measure, what do you count on a linebacker to do? Make tackles.
Yep.
Bobby Wagner makes tackles. And the important tackles that he makes, the stops, I think that's a great stat. Looking at, do you stop a guy, depending on, do you stop him short of the sticks on third down? Do you stop him short of getting less than second and four on a second down? The different ways that you measure that, I think, are much more indicative of the level of play he has.
He's definitely up there as far as that. Yes, he's very good at tackling, and that's a very big, important part of this. And I thought K.J. Wright finished the season very strong on that front, too. But if you go back to the thing that you just brought up, Danny, about how they have Bobby Wagner playing basically in coverage a lot, whether it's because of the 4-3 scheme or there are certain assignments that he's just not getting it done at, that Pro Football Focus decided to highlight when they said that both Bobby Wagner and K.J. Wright really struggled in coverage as linebackers. This sort of goes to where John's point brought me to. Because I remember when the Seahawks made that trade for Jadeveon Clowney, I thought to myself, on paper, this is a Super Bowl contender. And we listed a lot of that talent, and while you can argue over the importance of being a Pro Bowler versus a Pro Bowl alternate, those are guys at the very least that maybe should be better. And specifically pointing at the base 4-3 and the way that they've gone about things, I think this is yet another reason to pause and say things need to be changed with the way that they do things on defense. And that is from a scheme standpoint. And maybe it's from a coaching standpoint as well.
I don't buy the scheme needing to change. And the reason is because we've seen this scheme work. We've seen this scheme work at an extremely high level. We've seen, and for all of the different questions about the expertise of Pete Carroll in his offense, there's no doubting the defensive chops that he has. I'm puzzled why they play so much base defense against three wide receivers, Pete Carroll seems very convinced and had stats to talk about the impact that that had. I have questions about the template of the offense and whether that could be tweaked to maximize their talent. I look at the defense and say that's a reflection of them not having playmakers, because that's the side of the ball that Pete knows best. He knows it inside and out and knows how that defense and how that scheme. The one thing that you could say about it is that it's not overly complicated or intricate, because he wants guys to play fast and aggressive. And to me, that points even more so to the question of, okay, where are the guys that are stepping forward to take advantage of that freedom?
And those next guys that should be stepping up are LJ Collier and a Marquise Blair as well. The defense has worked in the past. Why will it work in the future? Why will it get better? What is there outside of Pete Carroll's expertise to go off of and say that, yeah, what happened this season was part of a building block process towards becoming a better defense?
The reason I can't point to one and say, hey, this is how it's going to happen. I mean, they need to get better players. I think that's part of it.
Coming back to that. And that is a huge part of it.
Yeah. And you hope that you get a nucleus of young talent that kind of grows and matures together. The fact that LJ Collier didn't play as a rookie and was a healthy scratch in the playoffs, that's not the reason this defense was bad. The fact that they haven't had any of their higher profile draft picks to really emerge and become stars,
right.
Like that's where it is, that they've spent a lot of resources on guys that they haven't got nearly enough of a return out of, or haven't made that breakthrough like we've seen guys before. Is that a matter of, is it luck and bad luck in drafting where they had exceptionally good luck early on? Maybe there's some of that. Is it that teams are now looking for the kind of things that Seattle was able to find in the later rounds back in 2010 and 2011? So now it's harder for Seattle to find the type of guys. I think that definitely plays a factor. But look, they've got to be able to find it. Like, looking for why there is a deficit, I think this is a personnel issue. And having guys that have not taken steps forward and become sort of that next group of leaders, and maybe they'll have enough in that critical mass to get there. But which guys do you expect to be better next season? I think you expect Cody Barton. You should expect everybody to improve. But who do you expect to be a star?
Barton and could potentially go down that road. But yeah, you're right. And that's the big thing, Danny. And I think that's the question. Is there talent here that can be coached up into something? And is this scheme going to lend itself to that? And ultimately, is it on who's bringing the personnel in, or is it on who's coaching this personnel up?
Yeah, I think it's a draft and develop team. I think it all works together. And the question of which do you change? I think you've got a pretty proven system here. Do you want to change the front office? Do you want to change like who's calling the plays and how the template of the defense is?
I think that there are certain things that could use some tinkering, though. And I think if you look at your defensive coaching staff, which has not had any changes in 2 years, yeah, you can say that the personnel that we've brought in just isn't cutting it. But I think also you have a responsibility to get more out of your personnel than you are. And that means some sort of changes, at the very least, in how they go about doing things, if not outright changes and bringing some fresh blood in. Danny and Gallant, he is Danny O'Neill. I'm Paul Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle. When do you know if you've got the guy, and how long are you willing to wait when everything in front of your face is telling you you don't have it? We'll talk about that next on 710 ESPN Seattle.